This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Severin Films, purveyors of the finest quality exploitation and horror Blu-rays out there. Available now, Claudio Fragasso's Night Killer. Gobs of love were heaped on this masterpiece of pure insanity on last week's Shockwaves.
Love it.
It's a brain-searing experience which has to be seen to be believed. It was released in Italy as Texas Chainsaw sequel, but really it's a slasher with so much more from the director of Troll 2. Also available now, Bruno Mattei's Robo War, a Predator Aliens ripoff Italian production shot in the jungle of the Philippines from the director of Hell of the Living Dead, Shocking Dark, and The Other Hell. And also available now, the rarest and lowest video nasties, The Beast in Heat. Almost too low, even for Severin, but nasty history must be preserved. We will say no more. Bundles and deals and discs and merch of the most sordid and illicit kind are available only at www.severin-films.com. That's severin-films.com. Pre-orders now being taken for the August titles, which include Wax Mask, presented by Dario Argento and directed by Sergio Stivaletti, from a story by Lucio Fulci, plus Never Mind the Gators. Fabrizio De Angelis, Killer Crocodile 1 and 2 are coming to Blu-ray and are available for pre-order now.
Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags is celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Blair Witch Project with 5 new shirts, a baseball tee, socks, and 2 enamel pins. Relive your childhood summers with these colorful retro-style shirts, popular reprints for Jaws and E.T. Listeners get 10% off with code WAVES10. Again, that's WAVES10. Fright Rags is also doing the Devil's work this week with an all-new, officially licensed collection for the Devil's Rejects. Also on pre-order right now is their new San Diego Comic-Con exclusive tee for the upcoming Creepshow TV series debuting this fall on Shudder. Greg Nicotero and his gang will be wearing these shirts all weekend at San Diego Comic-Con, but you can order yours today only at Fright Rags. Pre-order ends this Sunday. Again, listeners get 10% off with the code WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using code WAVES10 at fright-rags.com.
All right, welcome to episode 153 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. I'm sitting here with Elra Kane.
That's Camp Counselor Kane D.
Camp Counselor. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Another counselor will be Rebecca McKendry.
I specialize in archery.
Okay. we're not attending, but possibly the killer, Ryan Turek.
Rock climbing Turek.
Rock climbing Turek.
That's my specialty.
And we are all referencing Camp Fangoria, which I guess I haven't announced that I'm officially part of the Fangoria team.
Congratulations.
You forgot to do it last week.
Yeah.
I totally did. Yes. Yeah. So I'm working with them on the movie side of things. But speaking of movies, on July 27th, which is next Saturday here in Los Angeles, they're doing an event called Camp Fangoria in connection with the Arena Cine Lounge. And it's at the Montabaul Theater rooftop, which is where I believe we saw the masterpiece from Glenn Danzig.
Veronica.
We'll have to talk about it.
Wait, there's so it's a theater on the top of a roof?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It's a projection on the top of a roof.
With lounge chairs.
Yeah, with lounge chairs. It feels like it's a little mini park up on the roof.
Cool. It's pretty
and they
nice.
Do and the, screen, the headphones, right? For
the, they do the headphones. Yeah, it's really actually really nice.
Yeah, there's like a little bar area. It's cute.
It's okay. Cool.
So yeah, so this will be the first big Fangoria event in Los Angeles. We're showing, I don't know what order, but it's Evil Dead 2, Sleepaway Camp, and The Burning. Summer horror kind of triple bill.
Mm-hmm. And we are your camp counselors for the evening.
We will be there as the counselors. I don't know, maybe we'll get some short shorts, Elric. What do you think?
I got shorty shorts ready to go.
I'm going
to
wear Becca's short shorts.
I want you to wear my shorts.
I want to wear Becca's.
I will have a whistle and tall tube my shorts. Socks. I'm not wearing anybody's shorts.
I've got extra shorts for somebody.
I think I have a good photo of you looking like you're an 80s camp counselor, both of you.
Yeah.
Dead Right Horror Trivia Night.
We did
quite a few years ago. There's a photo of us. Oh, we'll have to look for it, see if I can find it. But you guys looked good. You had the headbands and all the stuff.
I teased my hair. I crimped it that night. I crimped my hair for that event. Did Ryan. And I was wearing his shorts. Oof. It was crazy.
I crimped other hair.
Well, there you have it.
Ryan is a live wire tonight.
I don't know what it involves in terms of us being camp counselors. I guess we just keep the party moving.
No, we're going to be hosting. Yeah. We're doing some trivia in between. Cool. I'm bringing some good prizing along.
Giveaways. DJing. There'll be some DJing that night.
We'll be keeping the kids from making out in the bushes, telling them not to smoke the devil's cabbage, that type of stuff.
I will not be stopping you from making out.
I will be encouraging you to
touch my face and make out.
Make out and smoke up, folks. Have fun.
That so should be. Let's reverse this Reaganism. Now's the time.
And we're going to Midsummer Scream, correct?
We are. We are at Midsummer Scream on Saturday. We are doing a live show from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m.
August 3rd.
August 3rd. I believe we are on not the podcast. There's two areas. There's the podcast area and then there's stage two. And stage two has a big screen behind it. So I requested that because we will be doing a visual countdown of our personal scariest haunted house films ever. It should be
scariest or favorite?
Top five. I was thinking scariest. I don't know. We could go favorite, I was thinking scariest.
I guess all we're going to need to start getting to work on that.
Yeah, guys, you were supposed to send me pics last week. So good job. Thank you for reading my emails. Go team.
So where aren't we going? This would be a shorter intro if we just looked at the states we're not going to be in.
Listen, this is for the next 2-3 weeks. So want people to come hang with us.
I do.
Yeah.
I was looking at our October and we're traveling a lot.
I don't think we're allowed to say yet.
Okay.
But it could be busy.
Yeah. We're traveling a lot in October.
I was doing that today too, like planning, and it's like I don't think I have a spare weekend.
I step off a plane and then I'm back on 2 days later.
And if you're at Comic-Con this weekend, Ryan's part of it. When's your panel? You're doing a panel
Saturday,
this weekend.
Tomorrow night. So if you're listening today, when our episode drops on a Friday, it is tomorrow at 7 o'clock.
What is it? What kind of
It's the Bold Voice of Horror. Mm. The Bold Voices of Horror. It's
which room? Which hall?
Oh God, I gotta bring it up. It's me, Akilah Cooper, Gigi Guerrero, hosted by Amy Nicholson. I did this last year. It was a really great panel. Met a lot of Shockwaves fans.
Cool.
Handed a lot of Halloween posters out. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. So, yeah, I'm super excited.
Are you hinting that you have Halloween posters?
No, I'm not. I am completely dry on Halloween posters. But, I'm going to get in Saturday morning, and I'm going to be walking around the show floor and having a good time. And if you see me, say hey.
So that means message Ryan for your show exclusives. I'm sure he's happy to stand in line and pick them up for you.
Yeah.
Texting him now.
Yeah, exactly. The room is, by the way, it's 23 A, B, and C, which is a nice sizable room. But it's myself, Molly Elfman, Akilah Cooper, Gigi, Adam Egypt Mortimer, who did Daniel Isn't Real.
Oh yeah.
And Amy Nicholson, who was the host of the Halloween Unmasked podcast last season. Mm-hmm. She'll be moderating it, and it's fantastic.
Cool.
Good times.
All right.
Awesome.
Whew, I'm exhausted.
I know, right? What movies do we want to talk about?
You know what?
I
feel like we glossed over or just completely forgot to talk about Midsummer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Eric and I dove into it.
We did one week, he did the next, and then you forgot last week, even though you had just seen it last week. But we can jump back in.
Well, people, regardless, three mentions is not enough. People want us to still talk about
Midsummer.
Here's the thing. Here's what I'll say about it. Ready?
Yeah, I'm curious because you're the last to see it.
I am the last to see it. I think Ari is a fantastic filmmaker. When it comes to storytelling, I think he needs a little bit of assistance. Mm. I think Midsummer is a very interesting film. I personally love Hereditary much, much more because of personal taste, personal things, what I like to see from horror films. At 2.5 hours, I think Midsummer spins its wheels quite a bit. I think it opens incredibly strong. I think Florence Pugh as Dani is fantastic. Where it ultimately winds up, I don't feel is completely justified. I feel like there's like a bunch of storytelling beats that he missed along the way. Because everything is an experience and that's fine. But I also go in for character and you can call me a pretentious fuck. But I mean, you know, Danny is set up as such an interesting character. And if you don't want spoilers, then maybe like jump ahead. But I feel like the whole thing with Danny is she's very dependent on her boyfriend emotionally because of what she went through at the very beginning of the film. And she makes this ultimate decision against him at the very end. And I don't think it was fully justified. And I feel like we were missing a few stepping stones along the way to get to that point. I like where it wound up. I just wanted to believe the decision more. And I think the visuals were all fantastic. And, you know, it was definitely an interesting film. It made interesting choices. And I love the fact that you can go into a multiplex now and find Crawl in one theater and Midsommar in the next. I mean, like, we're living in a great time where there's a lot of diversity in horror right now, which is fantastic. But I don't know. It kind of left me a little – I thought it was just okay.
So I'm going to give you – because I felt the same way as you.
Yeah.
Up until I talked to some of my freshmen in college about it. So I felt the same way where I loved Hereditary because I didn't see any of it coming, but I thought that all of the motivations were justified. Yeah. I thought that even though that it was these crazy left-hand turns, like it literally reinvented itself three times, I felt like they were all justified and deserved. This one, I was talking with my class this summer – about how I felt the same way, that I didn't think the end was justified, that I felt like that was a left-hand turn that I didn't get, where she's just one minute she's like, oh, I love you so much, I can't live without you, but you slept with that weird woman in the hut, and so I'm putting you in a bear suit and burning you alive. Sorry, that was a big spoiler. Yeah. But that said, we warned to jump ahead. I can cut it if you want, but we warned to jump ahead. But that said, I was talking with one of my students about it, and they said that the scene before it was the most important one, and then suddenly I went, oh, all of the women are in the hut with her, mimicking her exact emotions. Yeah. And it's the first time in the movie that someone emotionally resonates her and acknowledges her. Sure. And then I was suddenly like, oh, fuck, he never did that. Maybe it was justified. Burn the fucker. And so, I realized that they were mimicking, but I didn't realize that it was like this resonation thing that they
were giving her. They were acknowledging her and giving her a safe zone in which to, you know, there was an empathy, level of empathy that was
and
there.
And it's not about him. She hasn't been able to expel her actual grief from what actually happened to her family. So it's actually really about them as much in that moment. She's expelling all of it.
All of it.
And she's being accepted. Yeah. And now she has a family. So turning against him when you see kind of his weak ass choice. Now, I feel kind of bad for that guy because, he's a piece of shit like all of us were in our
20s. But they did give him acid and walk him into a naked woman.
Yeah, towards the end. It's
with
not like
grandma pushing on the butt.
That part I love.
You know what? You're on acid. Anything goes.
No, what I would say, though, just in defense of – because I have – totally different read than you guys. I actually think it's very purposeful. I think as a horror film, it's a little less effective for those of us who are really steeped in horror because I think what he's trying to do is show you exactly what's coming. So he's actually kind of making anti-horror in a way. Yeah. And I think he knows it. With this one, Hereditary is different. Yeah. I'm not saying that's good or bad.
Right.
But I think as a relationship drama, especially the first half an hour, it's like,
and even with those elements that you're talking about, I mean, I got that she's being welcomed into a family, but there's still much more story yardage
that's the part I was trying to – I was going to jump in because what you're saying is, so I listened to him on the film and it doesn't make up for the film, but on the film comment podcast, the first cut of the movie is 4 hours and he's literally like, he's about to pare it down to three, he thinks. And everything that you're talking about is what will be in that 3 hours. Basically, he said they could just never get something short enough with the relationship beat. So he even acknowledged it. He's like, it's all basically relationship beats that will be added back and not much horror.
Yeah.
And so it'll probably be interesting for some people in home video to go, oh, okay, I see her path a little clearer maybe.
Yeah, I'll gladly watch that because I did find, I mean, the film is still ultimately very interesting. And and Jordan, there's a great, in the new issue of Fangoria, issue number 4, volume 2, there's a great discussion with Jordan Peele and Ari Aster talking about the process of paring it back from that 4 hour cut. But what I kind of disagreed with with both of them is like they were relishing we're going into this movie already knowing where it's going to go to. Like, we already know what the ending is going to be. And I don't know if I like that ride.
See,
I actually agree with you. That's the one disappointment for me is like I knew 10 minutes in
and don't
kind
make,
of where it
right.
would land.
Yeah, we're going to a weird Scandinavian cult and you're going to end up as the May Queen because she looks at that picture in the first 10 minutes and says, oh, is this the May Queen? And then it's like, oh, Well, there we go.
Yeah, and it made me check my clock. You know, I check the clock regularly. Like once we hit like an hour and 45.
Oh, really? You actually were less. Yeah, I was definitely lost completely in it.
No, I'm on. I like it a lot.
Yeah,
I liked Hereditary a lot. And while watching it, especially like the first 15 minutes are like a pretty impressive, incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it just like the feeling of pure dread. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then once you're past that tragedy at the beginning, it's. I think Elric, you'd said it before, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. I've never seen a depiction of a couple breaking up more accurately.
Yep.
Yeah.
That like literally like from the first moment, there's not a single thing that either of them says to each other that makes you think like, God, why are they still together?
No. This is when we see that his influences are more Bergman, right? That scene from Marriage than it is.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it just felt like neither of them wanted to destroy the other person, but that they just should not be together. It was just,
it's a typical 20s drift, right?
And I was loving that ride. And then Hereditary has the same thing. In both movies, there's a moment where you as an audience kind of have to suspend disbelief and be like, well, I don't know if I'd go that route. Yeah. In Hereditary, it's in the parking lot of the supermarket where you're like, I don't know. And in this, it's kind of the quote unquote sacrifice scene where I also was like, all right, you kind of lost me here. I'll stay with
you mean
it.
The decisions the protagonist made right after that.
In both movies, he does the same thing where it almost becomes comical.
Right.
And so in that regard, I kind of wish this movie was just a half hour shorter because then I was checking my clock just like Ryan. And up until then, I was all in and I'm like, oh my God, this is like a masterpiece. Mm. But then it went on to the point where I didn't feel that way anymore. I was like, I still think it's a great movie, but I don't think it's the masterpiece it could be. And I do find all that stuff about him whittling it down even more fascinating because I'm like, I don't know what more movie there is there.
Yeah. Probably a lot of interaction, character interaction. But I think one key word that I think like kind of helps with going, oh, what was he aiming for? Whether you like it or not, it was a horror film. He was saying it really to him, besides being a breakup film, he was viewing it the whole way as a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And I think that makes a lot of sense when you get to the end. It's like, oh, this weird fairy tale more than it is about the horror of it. But, you know, it doesn't – I think horror fans are the ones who are going to be slightly more disappointed where it goes.
Sure.
Whereas I've heard from so many people who aren't really horror people who go, oh my God, this film blew me away. I've never seen, because they've never seen Wicker Man. Things that, and even the remake, the weirdest part was how it's got the one scene we were talking about afterwards, like the bear suit. Yeah. You're like, this is a weird Nick Cage Wicker Man. That was a strange, I wasn't expecting that.
I love that there's a voice like this making these movies. Within the first 15 minutes, you're like, oh, this is the guy that made Hereditary.
He's
like,
got you.
Obviously.
Yeah. He grabs you.
So he's got a voice. He's got an interesting style and an interesting approach to it. It's in theater, like a wide release in theaters. Like the fact that this and Us are the type of movies that are getting wide releases is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
The one thing I didn't think about, because, you know, we're looking at it from our eyes, you know, it roughly in our 40s. My buddy Scott Reynolds took his 18-year-old kid who loves horror movies and loves all that stuff and has had a steady diet of all the classics and everything else. And Zane walked out of it, you know, through 18-year-old eyes being like, I don't know for sure, but I feel like this is probably what it was like when you guys were seeing Kubrick movies in the theater.
Oh, interesting.
Like,
that's great.
He's like, I don't know any other filmmaker doing something
that's
like
this. And that is what my students definitely perceived it as. Yeah. Like as soon as they have each seen it, I'm getting emails from past students that want to talk about it. Like it is changing them.
That's great.
And people come talking about the relationship. I had like the person I work with, she's a production coordinator at work. She just comes, can I talk about the movie? She was just purely talking about it as a relationship. It's like, I've been there, blah, blah. And I'm like, this is so cool. You're not even mentioning the horror. You're just talking about like what happened in the movie.
Yeah. Listen,
I like that.
It's a generational thing for sure. Like in terms of like how it's impacting people, I feel. But yeah, it's like, if I hadn't seen The Wicker Man, if I hadn't seen The Ritual, if I hadn't seen like kind of all these films about,
Blood
you know,
Satan's Claw.
Blood on Satan's Claw, you know, all of these types of movies, then it might have, I don't know, it might have had like a, in terms of shock value, there might have been a bigger impact. But yeah, listen, I mean, like I said, Ari is definitely a fucking fantastic director. I rewatched Hereditary hours before I went to go see Midsommar because I just wanted that feeling. Because I had been thinking a lot about the ending of Hereditary and how it's just so masterful. And it's kind of like, catering to the bumps in the night tropes that you usually get from haunted house movies and horror films, and then weaving in this other layer to it. And you're like, what Alex Wolff goes through in that house, it's just pure terror. And I think that movie's masterful.
Yeah, I think that's a flat out masterpiece. And this is like an awesome sophomore swing where it's
I feel the same
way about Us. I love Us. And I love that it was different. But one other cool thing on this, just before we move on, is I haven't listened yet, but A24's podcast put out an episode today, and it's Robert Eggers and Ari Aster in conversation about making their second film. So I'm like, that's going to be an interesting conversation. So and Eggers apparently talks about how they wanted to just film The Lighthouse in Poland, and for a week it took a week to convince Poland that he was not a Satanist, because they were convinced, they were like, no, that director, he's a Satanist. They have to prove it to our office that that guy does not worship Satan. So to, before he could shoot the film there because of the witch. And I was like, oh, that's pretty funny. So so yeah, check it out, because I will say that all the interviews I've heard with Ari about this movie have enriched the movie, because you really see the guy having laid out his neuroses on a screen and not held back. And I think we need artists doing that shit to make this keep interesting.
Oh, you know, absolutely. What's so cool about it.
Well, that was loaded with spoilers. Should we make it its own little mini episode?
I think as long as we'll warn it at the top.
Yeah, we warned it at the top.
Because it's good for, I think it's good. I think people actually, some people have for a long time wanted us to get a little bit more into that with new films. You know?
It's been two weeks.
But if you spoil Crawl in 1 second,
oh my God,
I will end you.
There's no spoiling Crawl. You know what's going to happen.
All I know is Crocodile.
It's fucking amazing.
That's all I know.
They're alligators.
I will say there were a couple surprises in Crawl.
No, oh my God. There were so many great jump scares. Like, I saw it opening night in one of the very first showings. I was in the theater. I convinced a whole bunch of professors to come with me, which was awesome because these are not the people who would usually see horror films. But I was like, oh, no, we're all going to see Crawl. And they came with me. And
did you see this, too?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, my God. It's so fun.
Yeah.
There is a version of this film that is a sci-fi film. Like, there is definitely like a version of this. It felt like a really glorified one. Like, if you suddenly handed like Dino Shark to Spielberg, like what would come out? So it's just like a fun, you know, giant alligator movie in the hands of somebody who really gets giant alligator movies and is just really a master to begin with.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think also it is kind of, for lack of a better term, it's a perfect storm, you could say, of having both.
I see what you did there.
Of having both Sam Raimi and Alex Aja, because you get what Alex does so well, which is unflinching terror and violence, and then the kind of great orchestration of how to weave good jump scares and how to ratchet up the tension. I mean, Alex knows how to do that too, but you're getting it with a certain playful flourish that Sam Raimi knows how to do really well. So I think it's kind of like having those two, Raimi as a producer, Alex as a director, it's like, oh, that's a fantastic pairing. And the outcome was really good. I mean, there's some real goofy shit in it too. But I mean, like, just to show you how excited I was, I took the family up to San Fran over the weekend, and we had nothing to do Friday night, but there was an AMC across the street from us, our hotel. And I was like, let's just go see Crawl. I have to see Crawl this weekend. We got to go see Crawl. And it was great to see it with that crowd, because they were just jumping every 5 minutes. They were just caught up in the drama of it, caught up in the scenario. And
how's it doing box office wise?
Okay.
So it didn't do what they were hoping.
Yeah. I had read some, there was an article and a fascinating article in Deadline that, I tell, you know, all the listeners out there to take a look at, because, and it analyzes Crawl's box office in relation to like Meg, which came out around the same time last year, and Meg did really well.
Yeah.
But you know, the Deadline article kind of posited that, you know, moviegoers are being a bit more particular in terms of weighing the movie experience versus the ticket price. So like, paying $25 for Avengers Endgame makes total sense, because it's a major event. Going to see kind of a crocodile or an alligator thriller, you know, a low budget alligator thriller for $25 doesn't make sense.
Even though word of mouth was
really even though good. Word of mouth was okay. And but, you know, they'll see an uptick in, you know, during like the $5 ticket Tuesdays, you know, like the discount. So people want to go see it in theaters, but they don't want to pay Avengers pricing for it. You know,
I
which
totally
I thought
fair.
Was really, which
no,
I thought was
totally
really interesting.
True.
You know?
No, because there's definitely movies like that where I say, I want to see that, because we have the cheap theater in NoHo. And there's a lot of times where I'm like, you know what? I want to see that. I'll wait for it to hit the cheap theater. I can wait a couple weeks.
Ticket
prices should go down after 2 weeks, in my opinion.
Or should be in accordance with budgets somehow. Like
making a $200 they evaluate million, your $25. Prior year's tax return.
Seriously, and, there's got to be a better way.
But also, all that aside, you know, Crawl is just a really fun time. I mean, it works on all the levels, and, you know, performances for what they were great. And, you know, shout out to Alex for doing the right thing with the dog in this movie.
Oh my God. Yeah. And if either of you guys want to go see it this weekend, I will totally see it again. I need to see it.
Which previous killer alligator / crocodile movie would you pair this movie with if you had to pair it with a movie?
Oh, that's some pure cinema shit right there.
It's definitely not somebody on Twitter was like, it's good. It's like a Lake Placid quality to it.
I would say Rogue.
I would definitely say Rogue because it does not have the saltiness, which is somebody on Twitter referred to Lake Placid as salty. And I was like, it's very salty.
Yeah, it's that, David E. Kelly saltiness
to
it.
It's salty. Yeah. Like everybody's, I know, I love it. Everybody's got these comebacks and it's wonderful. Yeah. But yeah, like whereas Lake Placid definitely has this kind of quippiness to it, this does not have that. This is just pure alligator fun. So I would say Black Water is also a really good one to think of it with.
Is it Dark Water that's us? Dark Age.
Dark Age. The Australian one, yeah. Black Water is more recent was like Three Black People in a Tree. It's really good. I like that one.
And is it Severin that's about to release Two Crocodile? Did you just say at the start?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So we got a little
trend. A lot of crocodile stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got to catch up with that one.
Okay.
What you got?
What do you got, Rob?
Well, I was going to say, let's go to Veronica.
Oh,
since we
both
you
guys are going all the way back. Curious. Well, I don't want to hear too much though. You guys just talk about your experience.
You had a good time, but you sat kind of in the front, right? I sat on the balcony.
I was on the balcony.
Oh, you were?
No, I was on the balcony, but I was sitting next to some of the cast and crew who were caught up in it. Veronica.
This is the new Glenn Danzig movie.
This is the new Glenn Danzig movie. Which is coming out.
He directed, right?
He wrote, he directed. Wrote, directed, I think he
based
shot
on his comic
it,
book.
Edited it.
He was the DP.
He was everything.
Which is very obvious.
He was everything. Yeah. It is something that needs to be experienced for sure. Is it competent? Yeah. You know, like, here's what I turned to Ciara and I said, honey, I really like what this movie is trying to be. I really like that because Glenn set the tone for it right from the get-go. He was like, you know, I want to try to do like the kind of Euro trashy horror films and kind of like the Amicus movies and this. And
he's like Mario Bava.
Mario Bava.
We got to get him on the show. Yeah. That guy's going to be fun talking
about it. And, you know, and all that love was pouring into this anthology that is just fucking crazy town.
Because trailer just looks like his She Rides video. Like, that's the best way
She Rides video is fucking great.
I know. The She Rides video is hot as shit, but that's what the trailer looks like.
It's a little bit of that. It's a little bit of that, but it is super, super crazy. And there's like just very deliberate, insane decisions made on each cut and within each composition and with the performances. I mean, they are out of this world and you need to watch it. You need to see it. You know, I mean, like,
do you think he'll cut it?
I don't think they're going to touch it. I think hopefully when it comes out, like just to give you, I'm just going to give you, it's not a spoiler, Elric. Yeah, it's just to give you a little setup. There's like it opens with this young woman and this young man making out on a couch. And she's giving him a blowjob. And then she kind of comes up for air, starts making out with him. And then he's like fondling her. And as he tries to hike up her shirt, you discover that there are eyeballs on her nipples. And she goes, no, don't look at my boobs. And he's like, oh my God. And he runs out. And then she kind of has this moment where she's very sad. But you never get an answer as to why she's got eyeballs on her boobs.
No.
And what was great, but because the story quickly paves the way for something much larger about spider.
I'm going to go a step further only because this is the first 5-10 minutes of the movie and it's not even the craziest shit you're going to see.
I'm not too worried about being.
Are they good eye boobs?
Eye boobs is a good term.
Okay.
No, they're not. But immediately after the scene that Ryan described, the guy goes running out, she starts crying, and then the eyeballs on her boobs start crying. Mm. And a tear falls on a CG spider that came off a plant. And her tear makes the CG spider turn into a 6-armed giant monster. Sort of a dream demon thing.
Mm. And so and that sets the stage for.
So he lost 2 arms in the transformation process.
He's got six legs. He's good.
Okay. Back making sure.
Come on,
making
entomologist.
Sure. Look, yeah. I cannot handle insect illogic. It's not cool.
That's the least of this movie's problems.
Yeah.
And spiders are not technically insects.
But you know, just go in with an open mind. Go in, you know, ready for something that's purely Glenn and from his brain and from the world of the comics. I mean, get ready for one shot 10-minute takes that just linger on someone for 10 minutes while they do something.
Is he in it?
No, he's not.
Oh, that would have been cool.
No, but it's but listen, the experience that we got in Hollywood here, I mean, it's going to be the most, probably one of the most memorable nights, like horror nights, wow, from this year. I mean, it was a blast. And like, and to see Glenn afterwards come out, and he was like beaming. He seemed like he's a proud dad of this movie. Aww. and he was like,
I left, but what was his quote about cameras?
Did you, oh fuck, what did he
say? He's like, I shot this, it's got like, they got cameras, got like f-stops and shit on him or something. Like, anyway, I semi agree with Ryan in that it is a interesting experience. I do not think you have to see it. Because it's really you know, of course Dan's gonna come on the show and probably kick my ass. it's almost like people were telling him, maybe people were suggesting on how a film is made, how a shot is staged, how it's lit, who the focal point should be, how you can edit it together, that you should probably get more than one takes and more than one angle. Mm-hmm. And he was like, no, I'm not doing any of that. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to do it my way. So there's no competence in this, but there is sincerity.
Right. And but that's what Tommy Wiseau did.
Thank you. That's exactly, well, that's the word. Sincerity. It's very sincere.
He 100% is sincere about this.
Yes.
Even though he's a great musician.
Yeah.
He's just sincere in the wrong medium.
Yeah. That is a great way to put it. Yes. That might have
worked in a song, might not work.
Yeah. Yet. Or a comic book, which apparently it did work in a comic book.
Yes.
I would buy a boob tear turning a spider into a creature in a comic book. No problem.
Yeah. No, a close family friend from New Zealand was the comic book artist. So he lived with Danzig for a long time. Yeah. Very close friend from New Zealand who's not with us anymore. So, yeah. So I was kind of shocked when I saw the title, to be honest, of a movie. Cause I was like, what? That was that comic they used to do together. But, yeah, no, it's.
Well, and it's coming out officially, for Halloween.
Yeah.
But you know, if you can see it,
it's called Cleopatra.
Oh, Cleopatra Entertainment. Yeah. Cause they're
the same
a record
people
label.
Who used to do Cleopatra Records. Yep. I remember them in the 90s. They had a wonderful industrial line.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's them. So you'll be able to experience it.
What, I think they did like Pig Face. I'm pretty sure was through like they had some good, maybe not Pig Face, but they did have really good industrial stuff under Cleopatra in the 90s. So.
Ready to be hooked on a
title? Go.
Okay. Imagine Nicholas Refn style directing 13 Reasons Why. As an Austrian version of Spring Breakers. And it has a line in it where it says in Austrian, you know, do you think someone knows what you did last summer? Ha 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 ha. If any of that hooked you, imagine it not quite as good as what I just paid. Realign your sights and then push play for free on Shudder when you watch Party Hard.
Oh, I really want to see it.
Yeah, I have this in my queue. It looks
Some of us had it on our queue and watched the motherfucker.
It's a slasher movie.
Okay, you're actually the target audience for this because it is a slasher. It's for completists. All right. It's got, okay.
Well, last time you said that, I watched Party Line and I kind of regretted that.
Did I ever see Party Line?
Yeah
and you made me watch that one about the people.
I don't think I've ever seen Party Line.
No, I was the one that passed Party Line.
No, but last time you said this, I watched that one about the like 10 douchey like people in the desert.
Many people have written to me since the show saying they've really loved it. I didn't love that movie. I just thought it was interesting. Anyway,
I found it taxing.
Way to backpedal.
I never said it was good. I said I saw an article that put it in the top 10 of the year. I never actually gave it a quality. If you look at my letterbox right now, you'll see I gave it 2.5 stars.
It had moments. I think I gave it 2.5 as well.
Anyway, this film, so it is Austrian. It's lit like, that's with the only connection to Refn. It really looks like that. It looks like Drive. It's beautifully shot. It is basically Austrian spring break. So all these kids are on spring break. They go to this island, as you do in Europe, you know, in those kind of countries. And it is just like this week of partying. And it's led by these, almost like feels like a fraternity. What's interesting is it's probably like, if it was American, it'd be like the most A to B generic slasher you have ever seen. It's like taking our tropes and just making them so standardized. So nothing is particularly interesting that fun. What is interesting is that they're slightly different because of the culture. It's very modern. They use modern technology all the way through it to like as hooks, and to the point where it literally, if you've seen 13 Reasons Why on Netflix, it almost, the story is almost exactly the same, but as a feature in terms of the slasher why. Yeah. But it's a slasher movie and it moves and it's fun looking. It's, you know, there's moments where I was like, oh, I just wish this was a little smarter all the way through it. And even by the end, but it does look good and it's free. if you have Shudder, because it already exists. So that's
you pay that's for Shudder. That's it's free. That's the opposite of free.
Shudder's
it's
free.
A service.
Netflix
you're
is
paying
free.
Like 0.01 cents for
all the things I'm already paying for are free to me.
But if we fine. Total up all of them, you're probably dropping close to $75 a month. On
I think
everything.
You should really be shh. don't remind me of the money I'm spending every month. But no, I mean, yeah, no, it's fine. I don't think I'm the right target for it. But it's always interesting to see what people do with slasher. And it's always sometimes good to be reminded by, oh, if you just take the routine formula, why slashers don't always work. Because once you get to a whodunit, that's where they tend to fall apart. If the idea isn't, that's why, Happy Death Day worked, because it didn't matter. It really didn't actually matter that much. The twist, the ride is so fun and complex on its own that and repeatable, I guess. Anyway, so yeah, there you go. Party Hard, Die Young on the Shudder.
Cool. Right, I'll check it out. I'm super stoked that they're bringing Scooby-Doo back for Zombie Island 2.
Woohoo!
Nice.
I'm a big fan of that. That's all I got to say.
Nice.
No. Let me see. I mean, I talked about Crawl, talked about Veronica, talked about Midsummer. I think that's pretty much all I got a chance to see. Although I have been kind of pushing through season 3 of Slasher incredibly slowly. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to dissect why. But if you are into incredibly brutal kills, strong social commentary and a heightened sense of mystery, then Slasher season 3 is for you. And I maintain that it's incredibly nasty. It is still like one of the nastiest things I've seen on Netflix to date. I just watched this girl that they set up, who was kind of, questioning her sexuality and she was like into the world of VR and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden something really nasty just happened to her. And I was like, oh my God, like you just set it up and knocked her down in one episode. And what else? Oh, Los Espookies.
I talked about this last week.
I know you did. So
it's
we watched episode one. This thing you need to see Fred Armisen's show. It's basically it's so Los Espookies. It's on HBO. And it is basically, as Becca set up last week, it's basically about these three kids, four 20 somethings that do special effects and put on things. And when we first meet them, a priest is hiring them to do fake an exorcism in his,
Catholic school. Lost faith and he wants to bring them back. So he's like, fake an exorcism and then they'll all think I'm cool again.
Yeah, yeah, because, well, he's competing with another priest that's younger and more handsome and has really glossy lips. And then he like peeks his head in and this guy's got super glossy lips that you can't stop staring at him.
They're so glossy.
They're so glossy. But he's like, yeah, I need you to, he goes, we've got all these kids in this Catholic school. And none of them are susceptible to demonic possession for whatever reason. So we need you to fake one. And they come in and they fake one. And then based on the success of that, they start getting another job.
They get hired to haunt a house.
Don't tell me more. That's okay. But it is, in terms of the vibe of it, it's very What We Do in the Shadows. You know, without that kind of like docu-feel, it's just like fun, lighthearted.
The characters are super
so
over the top, but wonderful. One of them is this gothy, yet he wears blue all the time, heir to a chocolate kingdom.
He's the chocolate prince.
But yet he is this prince of darkness. Everything's very serious. He's always holding his hands like Christopher Walken in Prophecy. Right, yeah. I love him.
It is, but it, like in terms of coming from a place of loving and having an adoration for horror, it's clearly there. And you know what the funny thing is like we saw Fred Armisen at Veronica, at the Veronica screening.
He was at Veronica.
Yeah, and I saw
everybody
him,
was
and,
like
I, and I saw him at the Misfits show.
You need to get Fred Armisen.
I know, that's what I'm working on.
I know Bill Hader is also a big horror guy. He was talking about horror on the Gigante podcast.
In Los Espookies, Fred Armisen does not play a horror fan in any capacity. Instead, he plays a guy.
A
professional valet who knew at like age 14 that this is what he was destined to do. And so he practiced being a valet through like his teen years. And now he is like the zen art of valet.
Parking a Parker car blindfolded.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's fucking amazing. But it's just like, you know, if you're a horror fan, you should definitely be tuning into it. It's
That's on HBO?
It's on HBO.
The girl who played Toddy, I think. think is the writer, the girl plays Tati.
I haven't done my dive into who's behind it all.
I did it a couple weeks ago, so I don't remember exactly, but one of the main females is the head writer. So,
oh, my God. Yeah, after this recording, I have to go down and like go and binge the rest of them, but it's so funny. I love it.
That's Los Espookies.
And you know what? Season two, if they don't get fucking Spooky Dan on that show, I'm going to be disappointed because the main character just reminds me of Spooky Dan.
So much. He's like a slightly taller Spooky Dan. Yeah.
Oh my God. Where he is
happy and he is so nice to everyone.
He's super nice to everybody.
And he's just so happy and friendly. Yeah. And then he's like, let's saw that guy's head off. And it's just so brutal.
Well, the funny thing is there's one episode where they're, in the first episode, they're talking about like, oh, they want us for this party. And he's like, okay, so I want a skull. And the skull opens and bats fly out of its mouth. And the girl that's part of the team, she's like, I don't know if we could do that. And he's like, okay, then we're going to do something else. Oh, I don't want to give away.
Oh, it's so
we'll talk about it offline, but there's one laugh that I was just fucking dying over. Oh my God.
All right. Cool. I'll check it out. What else you got?
So my kids have been, we did swim lessons for the past 2 weeks, meaning I have been sitting at the pool while my kids do swim lessons, binging graphic novels. And so the swim lessons are done, so I won't be resuming my graphic novels intake until the fall. But for now.
Elric's giving her a look.
She just lets those kids run her life riot.
I know, right?
It just upsets me. You know?
So while I've been sitting at the pool, I read a good chunk of Clive Barker's Horrors, Raiders of the Abyss. Mm. So this is a Hellraiser spinoff line that he did with Marvel's Epic back in the 90s. And it is about a group of people who are somehow selected by these kind of angelic beings.
This is around Saint Sinner. I remember Saint Sinner, his comic. I remember reading that.
So yeah, he had a whole slew of them. And this would have been around the time when they did the Hellraiser line. But this one, it's actually pretty interesting. It is about a group of people all from different walks of life. Feels kind of demon night in that capacity, where they're all kind of gathered in this one place at one time. And it's like two girls who are like heiresses and princesses and some biker dude and an ex-con and all these people from different walks of life. And they're gathered there and they're told, you guys possess the special ability to go into hell and save souls that have been captured by Cenobites. And so one at a time, I'm going to send you guys into hell and you are going to capture these souls, reclaim them. But what they find out is because Leviathan is ridiculously organized. I love Leviathan. I totally get his OCD. That he has organized all these cells, the souls, into these cells in these giant kind of skyscraper-esque towers, each one containing a prison. And each side, each prison is everyone's different torture, like what they go through for the rest of their lives. So in the first one, it's a guy who relives this one particular baseball game where he lost the final pitch and things like that. And it's fun. I know that there would never be like a movie equivalent of these. I couldn't see that happening because it isn't Pinhead. It isn't the Hellraiser that we know. And it's much more focused on this kind of gang of different personalities all going into hell to recover the souls. But at the same time, it's a really fun comic book. So I'm excited to keep reading them. I read a couple of them. So that's Horrors of the Abyss. The next one that I checked out, I looked at because I just got word that a couple weeks ago it was announced that it had been greenlit into an animated series that should be coming soon. And that is Anthony Bourdain's Hungry Ghosts. And this is by Anthony Bourdain and Joel Rose. And I read the first few of these as well. And the whole setup is that, and it's apparently an ancient legend that all of these people would gather in one place and they each have to tell a story and kind of try to outdo each other. And then they have to go sit in this room of candles and see who can be driven insane by the stories. And it's set up with these chefs doing it. So all of these chefs, the world's greatest chefs, are gathered at this one like desolate mansion by this crazy millionaire to cook the most amazing meal ever. And they do. And then they come in and they sit down with these incredibly rich guests who have been gathered there, and they start telling these stories one by one. And so it's a really cool setup. So I'm excited to see what they do with the animated series. And then the last one that I read is called Spell on Wheels. This is by Kate Leth And it is about a group of witches, a group of kind of young adult witches who a whole bunch of their shit gets stolen. Like somebody breaks into their house in the first couple of pages, a bunch of their stuff gets stolen. And then it becomes Friday, kind of like a Friday the 13th series thing, where they are then traveling the country to try to reclaim all of their stolen magical goods that have all these crazy powers and who would steal them. They find that all of their stuff has been put on eBay and purchased by people all over the globe. So then they're traveling a lot to try to reclaim stuff. And it was also really cool. I think it was definitely targeted at a much younger audience than I am, but still very cool. And that was Spell on Wheels.
Oh, you're still young, Becca.
Thank you. You're welcome. You so much. No, this was definitely like 18-year-olds. So yeah, talking about boyfriends and breakups and mom and dad.
I'll throw a quick horror comedy your way that you guys might not have seen. I was watching The Cricket for all the British and New Zealand listeners over there. So I was missing home.
Do you call it The Cricket? I was watching
The Cricket World Cup. Unfortunately, we lost. But it did make me very homesick. So I went on Amazon Prime. A friend of mine who you actually met, you both met at your film premiere, James Ashcroft. He is my friend from New Zealand. He had given me a disc years ago of a film he was in with Tim Morrison, the guy who plays Boba Fett from – he's a very famous New Zealand actor. And it's a – it's really interesting, actually. I knew it was going to be goofy comedy, and I kind of just didn't watch it for a long time. It's on Amazon Prime now for free. So I started watching it.
What's it called?
It's called Fresh Meat.
Okay.
And what's interesting about it, and it's actually really interesting, is it is so the tone of the Santa Clarita Diet, like a few years before that existed. Like, it's not as successful. Don't get me wrong. The tonal balance doesn't quite work in this. For me, it was fun because it's set in New Zealand, so I get to hear the accents and have some fun with it. But it's a little silly, but it's literally some criminals are escaping. They've broken a guy out of jail. They're like a gang. They've got a shotgun. They crash into a house. So they're being chased by police. They crash into a house and hide in the house and take the family hostage. Unfortunately, the family they took hostage are a Maori family who have decided to get into – the father has decided to get into cannibalism to live forever. And so he's got this whole elaborate system. So the people breaking in have no idea what they're now into. And the way the comedy is treated, it's very Kiwi humor, but it's basically exactly the same kind of tone that Santa Clarita Diet was. So I was watching it going, oh, this is really interesting. I wonder – I don't think they would have seen it. But the kind of tone and that weird like between extreme body torture mixed with like really light things about eating the flesh. It's actually pretty interesting. So if you want to see it, it's directed by a guy, a pretty famous actor, comedian from New Zealand, Danny Mulhern, who was, I think, the cat in Peter Jackson's Meet the Feebles. He co-wrote Meet the Feebles. So he's been in a lot of this stuff. Super fun, kind of goofy movie. But I thought it was cool. I think you might dig it if you haven't seen
it. Is it a movie or a TV
series? This is a movie, but it really felt like what Santa Clarita Diet became in some ways. It's just not as nuanced as that. It's a little, on the nose. But interesting, my friend plays the cop, tracking them down. So it's always just fun to see someone and you're like, hey, there's James playing a cop and trying to take them down. So that was kind of fun to watch.
Fresh Meat.
Fresh
Meat.
You
tell people the title.
Amazon Prime.
I searched Fresh Meat movie and it came right
up. But I did want to plug, we both just watched Dream Master again.
I watched all five. I watched the first five.
Well, one to three, I don't need to see it because I know them so well. But four or five, I don't want us to go into here. But we
I
are
now
gonna
know
be
your
on
weakness.
Early August. Early August, we're going to be on a show called Screen Drafts where they rank movies and try to make the best 7 list. But this is a special one because us, Graham Skipper and Billy Ray Bruden, are counting, ranking all 20 of Friday 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street films together. In order. So and
including the remakes.
I wouldn't want any part in that.
But what I know is going to happen is I'm going to be, and this is why it scares me, I'm going to be the straight person in this. I looked at the names and I was like, these are people who like the craziest of those sequels. I'm going to be the one going in there fighting for the people of what's actually a good movie.
All right.
Suck it. No, you're not.
For you then.
I think I will be. I know some of you guys love, but I will say I thought 4 was fucking
I will say, I think I've swayed Graham on Freddy's Dead. He was like, I get it. I know, right?
I will rewatch that one for this one. I always hate it. But part 4, I thought was so fun. I thought it was so it just gets to the point of what Freddy's
part
doing
4,
at that point.
Part 4, I have to say, part 4 is like one of my new faves.
And part 5 was like,
I think we
the motorcycle death is amazing.
It looks good, but it's not Tetsuo, the Iron Man.
That's 5?
Yeah.
Ryan.
I mean, like, once little Jacob shows up, it gets dry. I mean, four was a blast because four had no intention. It wasn't trying to forward the plot in any way. We weren't trying to get into the son of a thousand maniacs or have a kid and I'm going to possess him. It had no agenda.
By the way, this is a tangential conversation, but
it's going to be about Midsommar again.
No, it's not going to be about Midsommar. It's not going to be
about the bear.
No. Have any of you seen Scream Queen, the Mark Patton documentary?
Has it come out?
So it's this Saturday and Sunday at Outfest. They're screening it Saturday and Sunday night. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to see it. But
is that here in L.A.?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Becca.
Maybe we can get a screen.
Don't you know anything about Los Angeles?
No, not usually. I have children. I don't leave the house. Yeah.
Fair. Well, let me see if I can get us a screener for it because I just read the Rue Morgue article.
Yeah, I'm dying to see it. Yeah, I think there's a piece in one of the early Fangorias.
Yeah. And there's also just like drama I didn't know about. Yeah. Like, you know, the writer of Nightmare 2, you know, kind of leaning into the queer overtones, but also how that kind of hurt Mark Patton's chances of becoming a larger actor, you know, like it kind of hurt his chances of being a star. And he'll, you know, he talks about it in an interview where he was like, his agent was like, yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to hide the fact that you're gay. And, you know, at the time Nightmare 2 came out, that wasn't, you know, that was something that was still kind of frowned on.
But it's overly, I mean, like it's so
But I mean, but you know,
except to the director, Jack Sheldon. Remember the Nightmare documentary, Jack Sheldon was like, I had no idea. Mm. I mean, I don't know if I believe it, but
there's no way.
You've said that, right? Jack Sheldon's just like,
rewatched it two nights ago. Yeah. There are so many close-up.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Like, for sure.
It's,
but
maybe Jack Sheldon doesn't know. You know, maybe there's more that Jack Sheldon doesn't know about himself. I don't know. I'm not going to go into that.
You know who does? Clue Gulliger.
Clue Gulliger probably does know.
But anyways, the newer morgue with Freddie undercover is a really fascinating read, and it's a great interview, and the documentary looks fascinating as well. Cool. So, yeah.
Part four was worth it just for the drama-rama karate in the basement scene. It was amazing.
What's his face? What's the actor's name? Who wears the headband?
Andre something.
Andre. I ran into him strangely at like a casting call in like 2001, and he had come in.
Why, you were auditioning for something?
Wait, what?
Wait, what?
I was working in this office, and there was a casting call going on, and I ran into him, and I was like, "Holy shit, you're the dude from Nightmare 4." And he goes, "Oh yeah, yeah, I am." And I was like, "Hold that thought." And I got in my car. I went over Laurel Canyon. I was living in Studio City at the time. I got my Nightmare 4 DVD because I knew he was still going to be in the office when I came back, and I got him to sign it.
Boom. Folks, this is an executive at a big company right now.
You know what? This was also around 1999, 2000, motherfucker. So, which was right when that new Lion box set came out.
Yeah.
Anyways, well, we have guests in the house.
We have guests.
So after a word from our sponsors, let's bring them on.
We're going to talk about Fidel's Cafe in Wellington, right? What? Yeah, we're going deep cuts.
This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Severin Films, purveyors of the finest quality exploitation and horror Blu-rays out there. Available now, Claudio Fregazzo's Night Killer. Gobs of love were heaped on this masterpiece of pure insanity on last week's Shockwaves.
Love it.
It's a brain-searing experience which has to be seen to be believed. It was released in Italy as Texas Chainsaw sequel, but really it's a slasher with so much more from the director of Troll 2. Also available now, Bruno Mattei's Robo War, a Predator Aliens ripoff Italian production shot in the jungle of the Philippines from the director of Hell of the Living Dead, Shocking Dark, and The Other Hell. And also available now, the rarest and lowest video nasties, The Beast in Heat. Almost too low, even for Severin, but nasty history must be preserved. We will say no more. Bundles and deals and discs and merch of the most sordid and illicit kind are available only at www.severin-films.com. That's severin-films.com. Pre-orders now being taken for the August titles, which include Wax Mask, presented by Dario Argento and directed by Sergio Stivaletti, from a story by Lucio Fulci, plus Never Mind the Gators. Fabrizio De Angelis, Killer Crocodile 1 and 2 are coming to Blu-ray and are available for pre-order now.
Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts with specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists. They offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags is celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Blair Witch Project with 5 new shirts, a baseball tee, socks, and 2 enamel pins. Relive your childhood summers with these colorful retro-style shirts, popular reprints for Jaws and E.T. Listeners get 10% off with code WAVES10. Again, that's WAVES10. Fright Rags is also doing the Devil's work this week with an all-new, officially licensed collection for the Devil's Rejects. Also on pre-order right now is their new San Diego Comic-Con exclusive tee for the upcoming Creepshow TV series debuting this fall on Shudder. Greg Nicotero and his gang will be wearing these shirts all weekend at San Diego Comic-Con, but you can order yours today only at Fright Rags. Pre-order ends this Sunday. Again, listeners get 10% off with the code WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using code WAVES10 at fright-rags.com.
We are very excited to welcome podcasters.
Oh.
Daniel, welcome to the club, Daniel Noah and Elijah Wood.
From Spectrevision.
From Spectrevision.
We're in the club.
Welcome to the podcast club, guys.
I'm assuming you guys have done other things to get you to the podcasting mountain.
Yes.
Like, I'm sure you had other careers that led you here, but those careers no longer matter because you're podcasters.
Because you're podcasters. And you're here with us.
I wear that. That's where it's at.
They make movies about podcasters, bros.
They do.
They get killed.
Halloween.
Yes, but they cast us as British podcasters. Yeah, we still feel that, Rye. We still feel that.
But no, you know, you guys had been on the show a long time ago with Josh as well, and we did a full Spectrevision.
Oh, episode 3.
Yeah, like it was early in this room.
That
was
early. It's been a while.
That's crazy. What episode number is this?
153.
So yeah.
Can we be on every 150?
Every 150.
Sure. Do that.
It depends what next iteration. You're podcasters now. Whatever you become next. Right. Prime Minister of New Zealand, perhaps. Perhaps.
Cool.
Illusionists.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so we, obviously that's a part of why you guys are here this time is Visitations is a new podcast on Shudder. I'm not sure if I understand the part where, you know, on the Shudder, but I guess I stumbled upon it. I mean, eventually I knew you guys were coming on, but I just shotgunned these and they're very easy to do that. But what I wanted to, you know, commend you guys on is this. I think it's very easy. There's so many podcasts being done now and sometimes with celebrities too. And you go, okay, cool. Mm. You get that angle. That's interesting.
Yep.
So I didn't know what to expect, but what I want our listeners, if they're not in on this conversation yet, is what's so cool is these are conversations that are with people. A lot of them we may have met or had on our show, but instead of the questions we don't tend to ask, yeah. We're asking them about their careers and the movies. You guys just go right to the heart of what makes them, what, you know, that you spend a lot of time talking about grief in horror films, connecting mm-hmm. personal grief and tragedy in the artist's life to mm-hmm. what they're making. And I think that because that is such a touchy thing, that is very hard for people. Have we never met a guest and they come and sit down? That's not something you really want to go to. But the fact that you guys sure. have their trust and relationships. And I think this is a very original. I don't think I've heard a show quite like it. And I think I've definitely never seen the people on your show so far, the way they've revealed themselves.
Wow.
And it really deepens what you're doing. You know, it's really unique. Wow. So cool.
Thanks.
I never ask questions. I just heap praise and then you can leave.
Thank you.
But where'd it come from? Like, because I think that's an approach that could fail hard.
Yeah. Well, look, I think, you know, we were initially talking to Shudder. Shudder had this sort of initiative to do a bunch of podcasts. She Kills. They've got some really great podcasts.
I was on that. It's great.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, I love that podcast. Yeah.
So they reached out to us. We have a relationship with them. And they were like, do you have any ideas for podcasts? And we sort of stewed on it for a minute. And what kind of emerged was the nugget of what became Visitations was this idea of talking to people in the creative community loosely tangentially related to genre so that it wasn't so specifically horror. It could kind of, we could, you know, push the bounds of what that was, but that it wasn't just a promotion show, that it wasn't people coming on talking about the latest thing that they had made, but that we could get into some kind of deep dive conversation with them that was a little bit more intimate. And I think maybe you had the idea of going to their home or studio, basically going to their intimate private space mm-hmm. to engage in that conversation so that they would forget they were having a conversation on a podcast.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, one of the things we talked about, the Maisels brothers, like can we do an audio version of Maisels brothers where the listener kind of has this feeling of, I don't know that I'm supposed to be hearing this. This is,
this cinema is verite for your ears.
Yeah, cinema verite for your ears. Yeah.
And part of why you do, just for people who haven't listened yet, you guys are mic'd up before you even arrive. Right. Yeah. And part of the conversation is just, hey, we're pulling up to their Anna's house.
Oh, wow.
Here we are. Yeah. So that's what you mean by you're trying. It's like the salesman, you're forgetting.
Yeah.
It's not
an interview. It's a document of an event. It's a conversation. It's a document of us literally visiting with a friend and having what we hope is the kind of conversation that you typically don't have on a microphone, the kind of conversation you have over dinner when you're, talking about why you do what you do and the things that move you and kind of, challenging each other to look deeper and look within. And I'd say we've learned so much from the process. Mm. I mean, we still have one more episode to do, but, but by the end of the nine, we were finding that we had made discoveries about why horror, the quote unquote why horror question. We had unearthed answers to those questions that were really surprising and kind of beautiful in a way. Mm. There were so many commonalities with the guests. It was really shocking. It was almost like we inadvertently were collecting data.
So what were some of the common why horror reasons?
Well, some of the – with a few exceptions – there were these sort of critical events in the childhoods of the artists that we met with that were strikingly identical. Mm. One is a lot of transience, like moving a lot.
Mm-hmm. Feeling other.
Feeling alien, mm-hmm. feeling like an outsider for whatever reason. The loss of a critical emotional support, either because of death or circumstance. Mm. And a lot of very, very fearful children, like almost unmanageably fearful.
Which we found too in our interviews with people and ourselves. That we're all scaredy cat kids who then gravitate to being horror.
That's become obsessed with it.
And it seems like it's about adolescence when it's literally like the coin flips over and now not only are you not afraid, you can't get enough of the dark stuff.
Huh. That's interesting because I remember reading a lot of interviews with the legends, Wes Craven, George Romero. And when they dig into, the why horror, where it came from, it was usually sickness. Like Wes Craven was bedbound for a long time. And I think George Romero had a similar story where he was like, I was bedridden for a very long time watching movies and soaking all of these things up and reading not famous monsters, but just watching old horror films. So that's interesting.
Yeah. But the same thing goes in literature. Like if you look back over literature, that a lot of times it was that there sickly was a kids. Sickness, like sickly kids.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so because they were sick, they just devoured content.
And it could be that their imaginations too. Like you're trapped inside yourself while you watch fun and life going by.
Yeah.
And I wonder if some of it is that we are big believers that one of the many infinite number of answers to the question why horror is that it's a chance to kind of practice facing things that scare you in a safe place. And we use the roller coaster analogy a lot, which I'm sure is not original to us, but that when you get on a roller coaster, you are literally having the physiological experience of I'm going to die now. Your body's being thrown around in a way that your the signal your brain's getting is it's over.
This is not natural.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're safe and there's something very thrilling about being able to walk away. Like, hey, I faced death and I walked away. And, we've come to believe that horror is the roller coaster experience, but it's a little more abstract and psychological so that, the Michael Myers is blank to you,
whatever you want to apply to that,
right?
And it's it's that an abusive parent or cancer or fear of failure. It's whatever it is that you
the bully at school,
the bully at school. Yeah. You get to face that thing in a very abstract environment and walk away. Yeah. And so I wonder with the sickness if that's a little bit of like there was an attraction to horror because they were grappling with.
Because you got
mortality.
Close. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
And
yeah.
I would say nothing makes, and this is personal experience, nothing makes you feel more like the other than having some type of childhood illness, like being pulled out of school for stretches and things like that.
Did you have a childhood
illness? Oh my God, yeah. Wow. I have a laundry list. Wow. Like, you know, I remember going to school, I had severe allergies, so I had to eat in the office throughout my entire elementary school. I had an asthma inhaler literally hanging around my neck because I couldn't be without it. So nothing makes you feel more like another than having a piece of yarn with an asthma inhaler at the end attached to it. But, you know, that was like my elementary school. And so, yeah, I mean, like, it immediately sets you apart from everybody else. The red hair didn't help either. But,
One of the questions you guys asked related to that, which I just find utterly fascinating when somebody answers quickly, because it's just – it's always amazing. But when you ask somebody, do you believe in God or an afterlife? Yeah. Especially Flanagan, which is hilarious to me because he's so good at making supernatural things. He's so quick to say no. Like, it comes out of his mouth. But then you start talking to him and you realize it's not really no. Like, after 5 minutes of talking to him, you're like, no.
It's more ambiguous than that.
But I love how in his mind it was a no, and everyone had it pan off. They all had different answers, and there's a, you know, I really encourage you. I thought one of the best episodes was actually with Anna Lindley. And she tells a story. She doesn't answer the question. She tells a story about something really tragic that happened recently in her life, and it's really beautifully told and nuanced, and you let that be half the episode, just telling one story and let it unfold. So I think, and I think that is relevant because as horror people, you know, you are dealing with speculation, right? We're speculating about what happens afterwards with all anything that's in the supernatural. And yet, so it's very weird when if somebody has a firm belief that there's nothing, I find that kind of fascinating in itself. So did you guys have any moments that you were in the moment you're so surprised that, or you're challenged by the moment because you guys are going into such intimate places?
The Lily episode's actually a really good example of that. The first episode that we recorded was John Landis. And to a certain degree, we were getting our feet. Like, we'd never done this before.
That's the only one I haven't heard yet.
We were still trying to figure out what this thing was. We knew the format, but it's another thing entirely when you're sitting with somebody. And he's a little intimidating.
Had him?
You ask him two questions and he just goes. Except for the hour.
But in that way, it was a great way to start because you don't have to ask much of him and he will tell incredible stories.
He talks from the back of his head the whole time. Like, there's no filter.
That is very true. But Lily was the second. And she really defined the show.
Yeah.
We walked away from that so moved by what she was willing to share with us and the intimacy that we were able to achieve and how vulnerable she was able to get with, you know, a friend, her cousin that had recently passed and all of these things that were so revealing that we walked away from that sort of realizing what we have.
This is the show. Yeah, this is the show.
So she kind of defined the show for us, and it changed our approach in terms of our questioning, how we were going to talk to these people, some of which are our friends, some of which aren't. She really kind of laid the groundwork, I think.
Well, since you're talking about how the show came together structurally, like when you made the battle plan for it, did you know it was going to be X amount of episodes? And how'd you go about kind of casting it and figuring out who to talk to? Because some of these people you've worked with. So was it a matter of like, oh, we know a lot of interesting things about this person that nobody else does. That would be a great conversation. Or basically, how did you come up with these 10 episodes?
We had a pretty big master list for a while.
We still do.
Yeah.
We hope we get another season. There's a lot of people we want to talk to.
I think one thing is that we wanted it to be a really diverse group of people. We didn't want it to only be filmmakers. That's why, you know, we've got Kate and Laura Malivi of Redarte. They're fashion
designers. I love them. They were friends of mine when I lived in New York City.
Really?
Yeah.
They're incredible.
Wait. I've got to add to this because you guys might not have known this. They actually talk about you on the episode.
Me? Oh my God. Are you serious?
You guys probably forgot because I'm listening to it through the lens. They go, that's when we went to Fangoria and Rebecca.
That's so much.
They actually talk about her on the episode.
That's right.
I forgot to tell her.
So. When I lived in New York City, I was working at Fangoria and they had come to visit somebody in New York. It was their very first fashion week. They'd kind of just taken off and they reached out to me, I think on like MySpace, and they were like, we've been following you and your career. career, as you kind of moved up in the company, and we want to come hang out with you for a day. Is it cool if we just come have lunch at the office? And I was like, are you fucking serious? Of course it's cool. And we literally, like, they came, they hang out, we had coffee, we spent, and then it's like every single time they came to New York or when I was coming to LA, we'd get back together. And then when they did the designs on Black Swan, I brought them in and did a huge thing with them in the issue. And it was the first time Fango had ever really covered fashion. But I was like, I mean, literally, they just did all the Black Swan costumes. This is perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
I love Kate and Laura.
Say, good tie-in. Podcast crossover.
Podcast crossover.
I forgot to tell her. That's incredible.
It totally slipped my mind. I heard the name check. I was like, I got to remember. I'll do it on air. But that's the kind of, as a podcast listener, that's the kind of episode I might skip when I look at the guest, because I'm like, I know. I remember they made Woodchuck. I haven't seen it yet. And my brain doesn't always go there. But that's an episode where I love, there's nothing better than being surprised by people in this world. Like, totally. When you go, I'm not that interesting. And then you go, that's fascinating.
Yeah. They're total horror fans. Like, one of the dresses, and it's a total, like, skeleton sequin number that I never have any fancy place to wear, but I'm always like, I own a Rodarte.
That's special.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
But I love their love of Hitchcock, and it makes a lot of sense, so because when you look at the fact, you know, Edith's head's work, design work, it's just, you can feel it in every frame. So listening to them talk about horror made me excited. Like, I hope they do dive in and make another horror film, you know?
They also interviewed Toby Hooper for a publication as well.
Interview. Artist on artist, right? Interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, we did know there were 10 episodes, and we wanted, like Elijah said, a very diverse group. But it's funny because it's kind of similar to the way when people say, like, how do you choose what movies you guys are going to produce? And I was like,
it's a feeling.
I don't know how to explain it. But I think the best I can do with the guest selection is to say that we try and pick people that feel enigmatic, where it's, oh my God, I want to know about that person. I don't have a sense of who they are. I understand their work, but I don't have a sense of who they are as people. And so there are some very exciting people that came up in conversation where they didn't necessarily feel like a good fit because their doors are open already. And like we talk about with Panos in episode 9 is that when we really started keying into what this was, the conversation that Elijah and I had was talking about when we were young and, you know, when we were growing up, particularly me, I'm older than most of you probably, but that when there was, you didn't have access to anything. Right. And, you know, I was desperate for any insight into the lives of my heroes, not the work, but information about who they were as people, probably because I was looking to know if I was like them or if they were like me or so I was greedy for that kind of information, as I am now. I probably watch YouTube where, you know, kids are watching, you know, unboxing, but I'm watching like Dick Cavett episodes, like deep dive, like, you know,
they're so good.
I'm still, you know, desperate for that kind of information about just who they are as human beings. And so, you know, I think that kind of became the guiding light for the show, I think.
Well, you know, you guys reveal a lot. Like, it's not psychoanalysis in the intrusive way. So, like, the panelist one was the first one. There's a minute at the top where I felt like listening, having had him here, and we just talked about movies, and he's such a good cinephile that it was such a fun talk.
Yeah.
But we never scratched the surface of who and why, right? Yeah. Why make a movie at a certain age? Yeah. And this was, I felt, for me, it's very inspiring. As someone at a similar age, staring down a moment where you have in your mind, I have to make this movie. His story about which I'd never heard, where he said about Beyond the Black Rainbow. But he said, I just woke up one day going, I'm staring at about to be 40, and I haven't done that movie, and I'm going to put everything in my life on hold, and I'm going to achieve this, especially after all the loss he had gone through. I found it incredibly moving, actually, the way he articulated it.
Absolutely.
And you could tell he didn't necessarily want to, but once he's doing it, I'm sure it's really good for him. You know, it feels healthy. Well, listening to it feels healthy. It doesn't feel intrusive. It feels like it's meant to, that this is a good thing for him to put some of these pieces together, you know?
It's delicate. I mean, we also want to respect people's privacy. And, there were certain conversations where I think we would sort of look at each other and into it like, I don't know that this person wants to go where we want them to go, and we wouldn't push.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to make people
Yeah, that's not our interest. Yeah. We're not interested in probing people for details about their life that they don't want to talk about.
It's a psychological hit job.
Not at all. Not at all.
But they would probably clam up if you did that. They
would stop. Yeah. It should feel comfortable, and you know, they are there to reveal as much as they want to, and it is an organic conversation that takes its own path, and we kind of help guide it, but it says they're as much a part of the driver's seat of that conversation as we are.
We're taking cues from them.
Totally. Yeah.
I love that you guys are exploring kind of the cathartic nature of making a film, because I think that compared to a lot of other art forms, it gets kind of buried, especially now that we don't have auteur theory as much.
Yeah.
It's kind of, we look at film as kind of films by committee now, especially when there's studio pictures.
Sure.
And so the idea that it is, you know, like other art forms where you're like, there's something stuck in my brain, and if I don't gouge it out and present it to you, I'm going to go nuts. Mm, and we lose that a lot in the film industry because it is a marketable commodity, and it's ultimately to make money, which art you don't always. I know. In theory.
Oh, well, that's why you guys have this big office and we don't have a big office.
But see, that's also why it was so interesting to talk to Taika.
Yeah.
Because Taika's seeing a really interesting sort of moment in his career where he's jumped, but he's also jumped from these personal movies that are these really intimate stories based on his own life into making Thor Ragnarok, a Marvel film.
Which he didn't expect.
Amazing.
It's incredible, but it was so fascinating to hear that he has the same fears, the same insecurities, the same sort of, it could all go away tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also really interesting to young artists that might be listening to the podcast, something that we also hadn't really even considered when on the onset of doing this, is that they could hear somebody like that and go, oh, fuck, I can do it too. I'm not that far away from him.
Yeah.
He has these fears and he's made it.
And
that's awesome.
And also at any age. That's the other thing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Know, it's like, you know, you're hitting 39 and suddenly you're staring down a barrel of 40 and you haven't made a film. It's like, well, still go fucking do it.
Yeah. Panos did it.
Panos did it. Craven didn't get into his directing career until he was like 30.
He didn't watch movies until he was late 20. Yeah,
exactly.
He didn't see it.
Altman made MASH. He was close to 50 or
something. Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah, Bresson as well didn't make a film before 40.
His career started at 40.
Wow. But Taika, the other thing that I think is inspiring is, and you'll, you know, having spent a lot of time in New Zealand, you know what that feeling. I think in America, when you're a kid, you still grow up with the American dream that anything's possible.
Yeah.
So if you love movies, you could believe you could be a film director.
Totally.
Where Taika grew up in a village, which is not what all of New Zealand is, but he grew up in like village area. That isn't even a possibility in the universe that you would even have the dream or even the idea. So I think that's, you know, he was an actor for a long time and comedian before that even became a dream. And I think that makes it even more inspiring to go, here, you make this little movie and then you're doing Thor Ragnarok. And when he talks about it, he talks about accepting it in the way where it's like, I guess I should take this because it could end my career, so I should do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and see what happens. And I thought that was really smart because otherwise, without risk, I think Coppola has a great quote about filmmaking where he says something like, you know, if you're not doing it with, it's like having sex without the threat of having a pregnancy. If there's no risk, what the fuck the point? You know, and it's like, no, there's something to that.
Well,
right?
Any art, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's without risk, why are you doing it?
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's the good stuff. And that's where you're probably revealing the most of yourself and the friction between those. But I thought the Taika one was really interesting too, because I think you're right with the enigmas. I think Anna Lilian, Poor Panos, and Taika are all three people who I think we don't really know anything about
them,
except for the surface you met, which I think, you know, it's a fascinating peak in a sense.
Absolutely.
But there's one.
Now Taika's doing Thor 4.
Yeah, Thor 4. Yeah.
Just saw that.
I loved his Ragnarok so much. I will totally watch it.
But one of the interviews, and it'll lead to other stuff you guys are doing, because it's different from the rest, and it has one of the great I was telling them the story that the Richard Stanley blood meteor on the eyes, because my favorite line is where he goes, but she came back different, and then silence hangs. And I was like, oh, I'm scared. I was on my drive. I almost said pull over because
I know.
I love him incredible. So
he's
much.
The greatest.
We had him a long time ago. He's a character.
He comes into the room and he sits down next to me. And this is when we were doing Killer POV. And he slowly turns and he goes, you have an aura about you. And then he turns back and I'm just like, what the fuck? Just, am I going to die, guys? It was just.
Well, you've seen the documentary, so, but obviously the reason I bring this one up because it also leads to the fact that you guys are you know first congrats on Mandy because it's just total home run.
Amazing.
We all love Mandy.
Thank you.
We love Thanos, but it's cool to see an artist who has had real struggles in their in what should have been a career. Mm-hmm. Let's use that word. He should have had a career
without
as a talent, but didn't. It's so cool to see 20 years later he gets a shot at a dream project, something that's very hard to adapt. He talks about how his mother was a huge Lovecraft. Like Lovecraft was his mom's favorite writer. I mean, what's
read
the chance
it
of that?
When he was 5 years old?
Yeah. Oh my god, yeah.
Which is amazing. So talk a little bit about your relationship to Richard Stanley and making the choice to as Spectrevision to work with him on such a an interesting project. I don't want to use the word difficult because I don't want to, but just it is. I think Lovecraft well done is a difficult property.
Yeah.
I think everything well about that the project operative. Is difficult.
When it's color of space, right?
Yeah, color on space. Well, I guess it started. I feel like I lost track of the timeline, but it's been many, many years. It's maybe been 5 years,
something like that. We met him at Fantastic Fest, was it?
No, we actually. I didn't. Maybe you did.
I think I met him actually in Morbido, but that would have been after Fantastic Fest because that was in October. So
it was whatever year Lost Soul was going around,
right?
I'd seen the movie. I guess you'd seen the movie and obviously we're very moved by his story. And, a friend of ours, a mutual friend said, he called me up and said, Richard Stanley? I said, yeah, sure. Are you a Lovecraft fan? And I was like, yeah. and he said, well, he's got this Lovecraft movie that apparently everyone is terrified of. No one will help him with it. And that was like, to us, that was like,
oh my God,
catnip. Like, yeah. Send it over.
Impossible. Now, give it to us.
Yeah. So, as these guys know, I've been, as the head of development, I've been banging this drum for a very long time of that. Lovecraft is, I think, had one of a profound influence on horror cinema. And yet, there literally has never been a faithful adaptation of his work ever.
It's so cerebral. It's really difficult to capture on screen because it's very much like, well, the creature's unimaginable. Well, then exactly.
It's unknowable. Yeah. How do you do that? But I think, I'm a huge Stuart Gordon fan, but I think with respect to Gordon, I think in some ways he did damage to Lovecraft because people began to associate Lovecraft with Stuart Gordon's voice, which is more very comedic. Different.
Yeah.
And so then, there's this suddenly Lovecraft became camp. And that's could not be further. Lovecraft, the gravity of Lovecraft, the terror is so deeply humbling. It's rooted so deep and it's not funny at all. Yeah. And so, I think The Thing is probably the greatest Lovecraft film to date. So, I'd been constantly going, I want to be the people that make the first faithful Lovecraft movie. And there've been a few, a little one. There was there was a Color Out of Space, a German film.
Italian Color Out of Space, or it may have been German. It had Debbie Rochon in it.
Yeah.
It wasn't American bad.
That one's actually pretty good.
It's real small. It's just three people on a farm, but it's actually really good. Yeah.
That's probably the best, I would say.
Yeah. Ivan Zuko. What's that? I can't remember the name,
There's Resurrected by Dan O'Bannon, which is it's not Color Space. It's just, it's tonally inconsistent. Again,
Annihilation, but none of them are actual direct adaptations. Yeah. So anyway, I remember I got Richard's script and the first paragraph, I was like, this is it. this guy gets Lovecraft and lost my mind over this script. And, so we met with him and, everyone was like, he's crazy, get ready. And no one will finance a movie with him. He's out of his mind. And we were not really sure what to expect. And you guys know you've met him. He's not crazy. Just smarter than all of us.
Yeah.
So I remember the first lunch I had with him. I asked him, I said, listen, if we're going to produce this movie for you, everyone's going to ask us, what have you been doing since Moreau? And I need you to tell me how to answer that question. And he said, I've been looking for the Holy Grail. And I said, really, what have you been doing? No, I've been looking for the Holy Grail. And he went on to talk for about 45 minutes about his hunt for the Holy Grail. And,
oh my God.
And
he wasn't kidding.
He wasn't kidding. And this stuff is so Byzantine and hard to understand, but those bleeding meteorites, he theorizes they are the Holy Grail, and he gets into that in our conversation in the podcast. But
I didn't for that part. I heard him talking about that. I didn't catch that part.
You almost have to listen to it a few times. By the way, that conversation was close to 3 hours, and it was a crime against humanity to cut it down.
It was extra feature. Yeah. Extra feature. Release it at the end of the 10.
We may.
We have a lot of extra content that didn't make.
But he's got a maybe, you know, if he was speaking German language, everyone would call him Herzog. But because he –
you're right.
I think there's less – in mainstream Hollywood, there's less interest in figures like that.
That's
especially post – Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
I feel like that was a then the documentary about, you know, the making of.
Sure.
I think it scares a lot of people, that kind
it's
of production.
Something, you know? The idea that it's something that we really take for granted today in society, the fact that he feels this connection with some type of larger source, that he can look at the earth or the mountain that he lives on and feel some type of celestial cosmic connection to it. Like, I wish I felt that about things.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I can't even fathom what it would feel like, but to feel kind of that greater calling that he has, this connection, it's amazing. It's
probably because he's removed himself from for a long time from this society, the way we operate with all our distractions.
There is that, but I also think he's a magnet. Mm. I think he's a magnet for things that we don't understand. Mm. When he talks about these things that are cosmic and magical and otherworldly, he's not kidding around.
No.
And I do think that they follow him. There are just people that are sort of beacons. It's almost like you know, the people that see ghosts or experience the supernatural a lot. I think that they're beacons for that energy, and I sort of think he's one of those people for that kind of
thing. Agreed. The one that we were in Portugal shooting, and his very, very dear friend, Yurani, had was the inspiration of the character that Tommy Chong plays in the movie. Mm. And he had passed away very shortly before we made Color Out of Space, and he's very alive in Richard's spirit, and he talks about him all the time. And Yurani was an amateur electrician who was constantly wiring things up, and so we were standing in Sintra, Portugal, outside smoking a joint, and he's talking about Yurani, and this lantern, this electric lantern above his head, just starts flickering and buzzing ferociously. And he turned around and he said, all right, Yurani, all right. And it like responded. Just like, and I watched him have a conversation with this lantern. I'm sitting there going like, I'm thinking, Richard, are you aware of how unusual this is? Or is this just how your life works?
Yeah.
And I asked him. We were like, and he, you know, he's just, he's actually very aware of how outlandish it all is.
The perception of it for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And he himself is like, I feel funny talking about it because I know it seems crazy, but you know.
There are always the people you believe though. Like if somebody tells me, like my mother told me when I was young, she's like, she doesn't believe in any weird stuff. And she told me a ghost story, but also would preface it by like, she doesn't believe in ghosts, but it made it 100 times scarier.
Right.
Because she has a ghost story.
Yeah.
So it's like, and I feel like we had a long time ago, Tom McLaughlin, who's the director of Friday the 13th Part 6. And he had one of the most – it reminded me of Richard. He just has one of those lives where you're like, oh, my God. He's almost Forrest Gumpian in terms of what it touches and the weird things that touched him. And,
that's it.
And you would never know it just if you met him for 5 minutes. But if you get the chance to go in depth, you go – the life can be lived so many different ways.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we all choose that. But sometimes we're not choosing. That. It feels like these guys were chosen for a path, and I find it fascinating when you meet those people because it's stuff that I could never get my head around. You know, he did mime work with Marcel Marceau.
Oh my God.
Wow. He had done everything. he's in the bear suit in Prophecy.
Oh,
in the bear suit. He said gave some feedback to Frankenheimer on direction, and Frankenheimer pulled him over and fucking laid it into him.
In the bear suit,
he had stories like that where you're like, that's amazing. You have an interesting. But he believed in electromagnetic. And he had all these like spiritual, interesting ideas. So it was just a very illuminating. But I think those two have a lot in common in that sense.
Yeah.
Richard,
Oh, I'm go sorry. Ahead.
No, you.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, when Richard came on the show, we asked him about his warlock friend.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
We wanted the warlock to start a Twitter account.
Yeah.
Is there a suggestion there? Because he gets like advice from the warlock.
It's kind of like Cheddar Goblin, though, really.
Yeah. Yeah. We were asking
him. You know
the
one who helped him with Moreau? The one who cast the spell to keep Moreau?
Yeah, that's the warlock. So we wanted the whole backstory of the warlock and how he met him and everything. And the amount of conviction and just how much he believed everything, like, you know, oh, well, my friend the warlock said I shouldn't do this. And it was like law.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine, but there was no question in his eyes about it.
Well, in some ways, I think it's funny because you mentioned that a number of our guests, when asked if they believe in the paranormal or God, immediately say no, almost defensively, in my opinion. And Richard says that was him.
Yeah.
Until he was just worn down and had to accept it. And in some ways, I mean, some of the stuff that we cut out of the podcasts were particularly with Mike and Panos were a little bit of like a debate about it. And, you know, I think with Mike in particular was like, I have a feeling in a few, you know, 5 to 10 years, we're going to ask you this question and you're going to have a different answer. That's certainly been true of me. I mean, I've gone through this arc of being incredible atheist and skeptic to now, you know, being a deep believer in this stuff. Richard, I think he's older and he's experienced more and he's just further down that road of acceptance.
How has he been as the film in the can at least?
It is. Okay. Oh, yeah.
So,
it's in post-production.
Because you were on set when this interview happened.
Yeah.
But so how was he on set as a director? Had he, you know, was he straight back? I mean, he had obviously shot a little bit in between those years because he did the segment.
And, docs.
And the anthology. Yeah. The anthology short. But I mean, how was he as a director and how was the shoot? Like, I mean, in terms of like, are you guys, I mean, I know it's a weird perspective to speak of because it's not out there. So what you can say.
It was great. He knew exactly what he wanted. Yeah. He was confident. Mm. In many ways, a week into shooting, it was as if no time had passed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He was the authority. Look, he wrote the script. He had a very strong vision for the kind of movie that he wanted to make. He wanted to be true to Lovecraft. And I think he was the guide on set for that vision. Mm. It was wonderful.
But also just it's funny because he's been hurt so much and he's a trauma survivor in many ways. And he literally didn't believe us that the movie was going to the point where Josh Waller literally had to get on a plane and fly to France in the middle of pre-production because Richard wouldn't leave to go to set because he didn't believe it. And Josh grabbed an intern he grabbed someone from the crew.
From production,
a coordinator maybe. And they flew and they literally were like, you're leaving, pack your bag, we're taking you to the airport. And he didn't want to go.
I think they drove. They drove him.
No, they flew to France and then they drove and picked him up in Montsegur then put him on the plane he didn't believe it. But I think the second it sunk in, it was real. It was like not a moment had passed. Yeah. He was in command. He was, and his spirit went from something dark and muddy to bright and glorious. And he was such a beautiful presence on set. Just so gorgeous. Cool. Everyone was the sweetness, the sensitivity, the earnestness, the sincerity. Everyone wanted to make him happy.
Yeah.
Was it as hard as, I mean, obviously everyone was warning you guys how hard it would be to finance it. And this wasn't your first rodeo financing odd movie. I mean, obviously Mandy's Take Out in a Cage. It's, you know, if you're on paper. So how hard was it to put the pieces together to get this one made?
We were so blessed to get hooked up with this group called the Ace Films or is it Ace Films?
Ace Films. Yeah.
The Ace Group is a financing entity out of Malaysia who decided to get into media, and they empowered this group of four film enthusiasts to select their projects. And so, you know, Timur and Johnny and Emma and Peter, they just loved the movie. Like it was kind of a dream scenario where you just have a single investor who, they were not real fussy about, they just believed in it and they just bankrolled it and kind of left us alone, supported us. And, they also did Daniel Isn't Real. We did Daniel Isn't Real with them. Yeah. And, they were just real like dream financiers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it took a while.
It was a long road prior to that.
But once found the right partners, Colorado Space was the easiest easiest production we've ever had.
I would say so, yeah.
No problems.
Wow. Interesting.
From financing to shooting. Yeah.
And if people aren't sold yet, if they're listening, going, yeah, I don't know if I want to listen to their podcast. There is a story about Richard Stanley being Dario Argento's drug dealer I'm not going to say any more about.
What?
Yes, that's all you get because you have to listen to their episode because it's pretty damn good.
It's great. What was cool about that too, and one of the things that to go back to the sort of format of the show, one of the things that we wanted to include that we ultimately sort of scaled back a little bit when we were cutting the episodes was we wanted to include the approach as well. So like, if we're going to Anna Lily's house, it's literally us recording the drive to get there. Yeah. Turns out that material didn't turn out to be as interesting as we thought, but we wanted it to be this sort of complete experience. And that story is actually told on a long drive up a mountain to get to where we were going to have our conversation. And that was just such an incredible story.
I don't think we even thought it would be in the podcast. We were just chatting.
We just got in this van and we were talking because we had a good like 20, 30 minutes to get up to the set. And that's the story that came out.
Yeah.
It's even better I'm not even going to ruin the spoiler, but there's a drunk guy at a lake falling over. And when you find out who it is, it's gold. So I'm going to keep all that.
Those are the moments that when we're actually doing it, we occasionally catch each other's eyes like, holy fuck.
Are you hearing this?
Yeah.
If you don't mind, I want to go back and talk a little bit more about Panos and Mandy in general.
Yes.
You guys will get a kick out of this. My buddy Scott Reynolds, Mandy was the inspiration, but this entire summer, every Saturday night in his backyard is Summer of Cage. We've been watching a completely different Cage movie from different periods. We just did Birdie, which I'd never seen before.
I've never seen
Barker,
it's
right? Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
But we've done everything from Birdie to Con Air to Vampire's Kiss.
Awesome.
And the only rule, because he's not revealing what movie, so you just have to show up Saturday and you don't know which one it will be. The only rule we know is that the final movie is Mandy. That is how we're closing it. Which is a very cool.
Yeah. So what we're asking is, can Nick come?
Are invited if you're in town. Awesome. But no, the movie, we saw it, Egyptian?
Yeah,
it was Beyond Fest because Nick showed up in his gold coat.
Yeah, he did.
A beautiful gold coat.
This is where he said he was the Klaus Kinski of the world. California Kinski. Pure gold.
That's right.
Pure gold.
But that experience was so potent, and I love the movie. I own it on Blu-ray. I don't think I've watched it since that screening.
Wow.
Because it's a lot,
right? It is a lot.
Mm. And I guess what I want to know is what was the, doesn't have to be the long drawn out story, but on paper, I have a tough time describing and imagining that movie. Mm. Obviously, I saw Beyond the Black Rainbow, so I know what Panos can do, but within like 5-10 minutes of that movie, you're like, oh yeah, this is the guy that did.
Yep.
Beyond the Black Rainbow, it's that voice. Yeah. How difficult was it to get on the same page and trust and know that that was that movie he was trying to make? Like,
it was so easy, dude.
It was
so easy. Well, we saw Black Rainbow.
Yeah.
And then reached out to him because he was in town. Was it the screening at Cinefamily? I think it was.
We saw it at Cinefamily and then we cornered him at Cantor's.
Yeah. And we basically asked him what we asked a lot of people at that time and still do is, do you have another film in that sort of genre space that, that no one wants to make or whatever, or just another kind of crazy genre film?
Well, actually, I think what we said was very particular with him. I remember this very distinctly is we said, we don't even care what it is.
Yeah.
We want to make your next film.
Yeah. No, that's true.
It doesn't matter what it is. It's about you, not about the material.
Yeah.
And,
And then he pitched Mandy.
Yeah. And, it was.
And he hadn't written it yet.
He hadn't written it yet. It was just all about trusting him and just putting faith in him. But, what to your point about, I forget how you phrased it, but you wouldn't know how to put it on paper.
Yeah.
No one knew how to put it on paper. And if you read the script from Mandy, there's nothing to indicate what that film is going to be. And
it's true,
which was hard because it's, you know, Panos himself has this phrase, the tyranny of narrative, mm-hmm. that he believes that movies should be essentially plotless. And, you know, Mandy, nothing happens. I mean, you know, everything happens, but, you know, in terms of like, you know, Ryan, like what we do, you know, where you're like, all we do all day is talk to writers about like story events.
Yeah, yeah.
There's pretty much just one in Mandy. And then everything is sort of like this reverberation backwards and forwards through time from that one traumatic event. And so on paper, it's just like a real kind of underwhelming revenge movie with no plot. And so what we figured out right away was that you had, well, you disagree?
Sort of. The script was pretty stunning. It actually did jump off the page. I think, but how much of that was you overlaying
your awareness of his
vision? It's a mix of those things. Yeah. I think to your point and to what you're saying, what that movie is it's, you can't extrapolate that from the page.
Yeah.
You cannot.
Yeah.
There's just no way. Mm. What you can extract from the page is really great characters. The love story of Mandy and Red was very palpable.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, reading that on the page, you immediately go, oh, fuck, this isn't just another revenge movie that is just going to give us that sort of revenge fantasy and it's meaningless. It was for something. And you felt the reverberation of that love story throughout the script.
Definitely.
So those things were very much there.
But I would say just, I guess I'm talking more from the perspective of trying to get it financed.
Totally.
Was that, you know, people
it was also really ambitious too.
Yeah. It was hard to explain why it was special because they'd read and go like, oh, so it's like John Wick, but without all the John Wick stuff. So and so what we finally realized was that there came a point both with appealing to financiers and casting the rest of the movie where we would literally say, just start by watching Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Yeah.
And let's not even get into what Mandy is yet. that was when things started to change.
Yeah.
And particularly with casting, like, mm-hmm. you know, we were striking, you know, I mean, Nick was the first, he was exact, you know, who Net Panos wanted, but it was filling out the rest of the cast that was initially challenging. And when we finally changed up the strategy and started leading with Beyond the Black Rainbow was when actors start falling in.
Yeah. People understood it from there. Yeah. On out.
Had Panos included any of kind of what I'll call his visual stuff in the script? Like, did it say anything like, you know, actor breaks down in bathroom for 20 minutes or, you know, faces blend together or anything like that. So none of the shiny stuff was in the script.
Not really, not in the way that it's expressed in the film.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what I mean when I say that the script was, it was difficult to think of it as a document of the cinematic experience. So while, you know, the story was fleshed out, it didn't indicate the genius of Panos Cosmatos.
Linus is actually the one that spoke to it the best.
Yeah.
Linus Roach, who plays, why am I forgetting his
Trump,
name?
Donald Trump. Here's my dick.
Jeremiah Sand.
Yeah. He read the script and didn't understand it.
Yeah.
At all. And then I think he watched Beyond the Black Rainbow and was like, I get it. But he was repulsed by it.
He was repulsed by it.
He was repulsed by it and the sort of toxic masculinity and all of these things.
I'd say that's a good reaction.
Yeah.
Especially the role. It's a frightening role to probably take on.
Totally fair.
But he goes all in. I mean, Jesus, it's such a good performance.
It's such an extraordinary performance.
But I think this film's a huge leap for Panos because I like Beyond the Black Rainbow a great deal and I see all the visual talent. And I saw it, you know, in the New Zealand Film Festival when it first came out.
Oh,
but,
cool.
But what Mandy is an emotional story, and that's the maturity shown in the emotion of that film. And it hits me towards the end of that movie where he looks, has a flashback, and he thinks they see each other. I even now it affects me because it's what's taken, you know. And revenge films, I love revenge films,
me too.
But they tend to not allow all the emotion to actually be explored. They tend to just use it as a device, like rape is a device or whatever And what you want is you want to see the loss. You want to like you guys kept saying on your podcast, horror is a grief genre.
Yeah,
I think it's very apt with this film, and I feel like maybe some of the things he's revealing in the podcast about his personal life, he's found a way to channel through these characters in this scenario.
Yeah.
And that's why it really resonates. You know?
Definitely.
It's really strong.
I think even the animation was quite late in the process in terms of the decision to have those animated sequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that was so brilliant because it kept her alive after her death. You're constantly reminded of her.
Yeah,
and she's a presence throughout the film.
Yeah.
So brilliant.
Great. Yeah.
So what's up next in theaters, Daniel Isn't Real, which I think just got a release date today or the week that we're recording this.
December 7th.
I think.
And who's releasing?
Sam Goldwyn.
Nice. And then like with a Shutter.
Samuel Goldwyn and Shutter. Got it.
Don't talk about movies. They're podcasters. Okay? Why do you got to muddy it?
Well, just a sneak peek at that one. Adam Egypt Mortimer, who had also directed a film called Some Kind of Hate. I was just telling these guys out in the hall that it's a giant step forward for Adam in terms of a level of filmmaking maturity. Daniel Isn't Real. I didn't really talk about it after I had seen it, but it's one that just kind of got under my skin. It's really, really fantastic. Miles Robbins is the lead in it, and it's kind of a fucked up imaginary friend story. It goes into some really unique areas and it wraps up beautifully. And the feeling I had after watching it is like, I had to call Adam afterwards and just congratulate him on the car ride. I was just like, dude, this thing, it just got in and like in there real deep. And there's some really interesting stuff there.
Sounds like Beyond Fest. Sounds like we're not going to get a record, but it sounds like we'll get to see it Beyond Fest. It sounds like, I can't let you go without talking about the greatest New Zealand director that no one knows of. And it's not who you think it is. It is a dear friend, Ant Timpson.
Have you seen
Come I to haven't, Daddy? But I you can ask Ant. I am the sole fan of his first short film 20 years ago called Crab Boy.
Whoa.
And he doesn't show anyone. And it is fucking awesome. It's like this really dark, fucked up black and white. I don't even know where I saw it back in the day. I talk about that movie, and I always thought he should make more movies. I mean, he's been a producer for a long time, and I just remember this like 10 years ago. He's like, I'm never going to make another movie. No, it's never going to. And so when I didn't even really know about it until I started seeing it pop up for Tribeca. So I was really excited. So for people who don't know, Ant ran, and I've talked about him a lot on the show, and just because my birth as a cinephile came largely from the Incredibly Strange Film Fest that he ran.
Yep.
And he's one of the four or five biggest print collectors probably in the world. He gives
some
of his prints
to Dubev.
Certainly
the biggest of the Southern Hemisphere.
Definitely. We didn't have any retro stuff at all down there. So he trades with Cinephile and Tarantino and all those people. That's a network. But he was, New Zealand genre has always been kind of bastardized, I think, especially horror. You know, it's like they would make one occasionally, but it's really just to float the books. There wasn't that passion before Peter Jackson, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting.
And it's growing, for sure.
But. It didn't quite, because it was Australia had the bigger...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
...sort of genre exploitation
New Zealand
scene.
Dramas are dark. That's the interesting thing. All the dramas are already super dark, so
really
maybe that's why. But
Once
so,
the Warriors.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, they're all, they all kind of show this isn't paradise, right? Mm. But Ant's obviously helped a lot. ABCs of Death, he's one of the producers of that.
Housebound.
Yeah, him and Tim League are very...
Deathgasm.
Turbo Kids. He's been doing a lot more lately.
We worked with them on Greasy Strangler as well.
So obviously this I know nothing about it. I saw him when he just passed through recently, and he said, I'll send you a screen. I said, no, I want to see it on screen. So tell us a little bit about what it is, and also just maybe working what it was like to work with somebody who
was
his first
movie?
Feature Come to Daddy. But it just sounds interesting.
I love it. It's a weird little genre piece that's based on a very tragic thing that happened to him. So his father died. It was about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. And his father's girlfriend was Maori, and they had a sort of similar tradition of like sitting Shiva kind of thing, where the body remains in the house for a week, and then family members kind of cycle through to pay respects to the body. Well, most of his family were disturbed by that and left. So he was left alone in the house with his father for a week. And while he was there, he went through a series of emotions, as you would. There was this sort of steady stream of people who he'd never met that were really close to his father from another life. And he learned about his father from all these people, this whole other version of him that he'd never heard of. And so it was just all of these things kind of culminated in him realizing, also with the death of his father, that he had to get off his ass and make a film again. That was the inspiration point, and he thought, well, this will be the film. It'll be about this. And he reached out to Toby, who wrote The Greasy Strangler, and he was like, I've got this idea. What do you think? And they sort of bounced the thing together, and Toby wrote the first draft, and then they sort of honed it together. That became Come to Daddy, and it's sort of that story is the jumping off point, but it's basically about a son reuniting with his father, and his father dies. And he's left in the house with his father, and then things kind of go a little crazy from there. And that's the kind of beginning of the story.
As an actor, what was your in for the, like, we, so that's his story. How do you as a performer get your, what's your in to a character like that? Do you, is it personal or is it, are you just taking in the stories with, and kind of like when you guys do the interviews, I think this whole story sounds very much like the interviews you guys are doing.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Somewhat personal. I mean, I guess I was estranged from my father for a bit. So there was something that I could kind of maybe even in the back of my mind and intuit in regards to that. That performance, I suppose, but bless you.
Thank you.
But I just fell in love with the script. I, you know, Ant sent it to me along with a photo of Skrillex, and he's like, "This is what I want the character to look like." And I was like,
"You
wow.
look like Skrillex in it?"
No, it's I look like a kind of hipster monk.
That's kind of awesome.
It's he's a weird dude, very entitled, and with bad fashion sense. But I just fell in love with the story, and I was endeared to what Ant had gone through, but what Toby and Ant kind of conceived together was really fucking hilarious and kept me guessing as a reader. I just never knew where it was going, and it also would set things up that it constantly paid off. So it was just really this taut, beautiful thing that kind of kept becoming different movies as it was going along. So, I mean, my entry point was somewhere between what had been written, conversations with Ant, and then me sort of trying to craft this weird little dude.
So that's another one we'll hopefully see at Beyond Fest. Yeah. Us in LA. We just sit around waiting for Beyond Fest every year.
I might be playing. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, cool. Very cool.
Well, awesome.
Yeah, well, guys, so I mean, yeah.
We're good. Obviously, we could find the podcast on Shudder and on iTunes.
Any app, yeah.
iTunes. It's on Spotify. Yeah. Anywhere. It's everywhere.
Anywhere.
What's a podcast on Shudder like? I've never actually.
That's what I.
So you can actually go either on the app on your phone or Apple TV, however you do it, and it's there. You can just listen to it.
Like some fun visuals while it plays on your TV.
So yeah, Jay Shaw actually did all of our art design. No kidding. So the logo design, and then there's a different piece of art, almost like an album.
We did like album covers.
Oh, cool.
Kind of like 1960s library records.
Yeah.
Was sort of the idea.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you watch it on Shudder, you actually see those album covers and can look at that when you listen to me.
And if we listen, there's a better chance of a season two if everyone pitches and it makes a comment.
Yes, please.
Comment on iTunes.
Like, we really loved doing this.
Yeah.
We hope people love listening to it, but we would love to do it again just because we love having these conversations. And honestly, we learn, like we've said earlier, we learn as much, if not more, than anybody else. Like, it's a learning experience for us.
That's gorgeous.
That's why I want people to understand that, just because, you know, we've had Panos on our show. You haven't heard this part of it. And that's why I think I was drawn to it. And I think that's why I'll appeal to people. They haven't seen this side of people.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Super cool.
That's great.
Cool. Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks for coming by.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
We'll see you for 303.
Heck yeah. It's a date. All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.